Welcome to episode 4 of season 5 of A Year in a Day. I'm your host, Jamie Davis. Addressing how to deal with the family business during a divorce is a fairly common issue. And for many business owners, the divorce process will involve critical decisions about the future of their company. If spouses cannot agree on the value of their business, an expert is usually brought in to perform a formal business valuation. Today, we will be discussing issues related to valuing a family business in an uncertain economy with CPA and certified valuation analyst David Amos. David is a partner with Carr, Riggs & Ingram and is responsible for valuation and litigation services for attorneys, CPAs, and their clients. David has over 15 years of experience in public accounting, which includes business valuations, tax, accounting, and advisory services. David graduated from Valdosta State University with a degree in accounting and obtained a master's degree in accounting from Georgia Southern University. Welcome, David.
Hey, thank you, Jamie, for having me.
So let's jump right in. We have a lot of really good ground to cover today. How does the valuation process work in a typical divorce case?
From my perspective, the valuation expert, it typically goes as follows. There's an introductory conversation, typically with the attorney, sometimes with the attorney and the spouse that's going through divorce. And in that conversation, we'll discuss the engagement type. There are different types of valuations that we can do. So we talk about, you know, where we're at in the process, in the divorce process, and discuss engagement type, the standard of value, which is pretty important, the timeline, when it's needed, if there's mediation or trial, or when a report is needed. We discuss fees and various other things such as passive or active components that we may get into later. From there, that'll drive the drafting of the engagement letter, the contract, typically to the attorney, sometimes to the spouse. And a list of documents that we'll need. It's not a conclusive list, but it's most of the items that we'll need to get started and make some progress on the valuation. From there, using the historical information, we'll begin to enter it into our software. So the analysis, the historical analysis that we'll do, which will include looking at the company, the industry, and the economic factors, will provide a basis for questions that will then go to management, which will then allow us to understand and project where the company is going. From there, we'll finalize the value, which has several aspects to it. We'll draft a report, discuss the report with the attorney, users, or whomever, and then testimony if required.
Okay, so this sounds like it's a pretty comprehensive process. When you are preparing a valuation of a business in connection with a divorce case, what is the standard of value that you use?
Yeah, it's a great question and a very important question. So for North Carolina, the general statutes reference net value. The case law then helps us to understand what that is. And the best way to explain standard of value in equitable distribution context in North Carolina is to say it's hybrid. There are components of fair market value and there are components of investment value. Fair market value connotes it's the value in the market, if you will, or perhaps we could refer to it as a value in exchange in which somebody is buying and selling an interest. And so it's different than investment value. Investment value is the value to the person that's holding the ownership interest. And so perhaps a good example to explain it, and this it happened in a family law context, a person owned an insurance agency. And with this agency and the contract they had with the folks that were allowing them to sell the insurance, they could not sell their company. They couldn't go into the open market and somebody buy that book of business from them, if you will. And so that has value to the person that holds the interest at that time, but it doesn't have any value in the market. And so under the investment value, that company would be worth more than under the fair market value, standard value. So does that help or make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. That makes perfect sense. So how is fair market value determined? Is it just the company assets less its debts, or are there other things that are taken into consideration?
Yeah, I think you pretty much hit it, at least for the asset approach, but there are two other approaches that we use, the income and the market. So the asset approach is the fair market value of the assets less liabilities. This typically results in a floor value, if you will, because the intangible assets are not reflected on the balance sheet. The income approach is one that we use a lot, and it is relatively simple to understand using a mathematical formula. So the value of a company through the income approach is value equals benefits over return. And so what benefits is a company capable of producing into the future? Because we're not buying past results, we're buying future potential. And so what benefits, i.e. cash flows or net income, is a company capable of producing in the future? And with any benefit stream is going to come some level of risk. And so what rate of return does an investor require to make that investment? And so value equals the benefits over or divided by a rate of return. And then the third approach is a market approach. And so within the market approach, we review companies in a similar industry that have sold, and specifically the relationship between the sales price and the financial data for that company. So revenue. And so we'll look at the sales price and divide it by the revenue to come up with a multiple and then apply to the subject company that we're using.
In your experience, when you are valuing a business for a divorce case, which approach would you say is the most common?
The most common is the income approach. The asset approach is typically only used if it's a holding company. So family limited partnerships to hold land or stocks and bonds. But for an operating company that's not asset intensive, like a trucking company, the income approach is typically the best approach. The market approach is sometimes used as a sanity check. The valuator or the appraiser may end up weighting their final conclusion of value on both income and market, but the market at the very least can provide a sanity check that similar companies are selling for similar values that we determine through the income approach.
When you are valuing a company, do you ever discount the value for any reason?
Yeah, discounts can apply typically for two reasons or two different kinds of discounts: discount for lack of control and discount for lack of marketability. The discount for lack of control is intended to reflect the reduction or the diminution of value associated with an ownership interest that doesn't control the business and operations. The inability to determine the direction of the company, the day-to-day operations, when dividends or returns of equity will be paid out, and when the business will ultimately be sold and be able to recoup your investment. We typically apply a discount for lack of control there. The second discount is for marketability or liquidity. And so if you have a controlling interest in a private company in a small business, like we see in equitable distribution context, or minority interest, there's not a ready market for that. If you owned a share of Apple stock, you could convert that share of Apple stock to cash in 3 days. If you wanted to sell an interest in XYZ small business and you wanted to sell today, you're ready to sell today. When's that sale going to be consummated and have the cash in hand? At the very least, it's probably 6 to 9 months out. And so that discount is intended to reflect that diminution of value because you can't sell it right now and convert it to cash.
So that's really interesting. I would think there might be a little subjectivity here. How do you determine what discount rate should be applied?
For the discount for lack of control, one of the things that we do is we look at publicly traded companies. If you buy those stocks, that is a non-controlling marketable value. And stick with me there. So you don't control it, but it is marketable. And so when shares in those companies or when that company goes from being controlled by a few people to a controlling interest, the premium that a person is willing to pay to go from a minority interest to a controlling interest, the inversion of that can give us or tell us what the discount for control is. Discount for marketability, sometimes we look at restricted stock studies. And so when restricted stock shares are issued, there's typically a requirement that you can't resell those in a certain period of time. And that change in value from the restricted stock shares to the unrestricted stock shares can be a good proxy for marketability discount.
So we've determined the discounts, we've looked at the financials, business valuation is going along. When you are valuing a business for equitable distribution, which for those listeners who don't know is the division of property between separated spouses, how do you decide what date you are valuing the company as of?
In North Carolina, we use the date of separation. So we're relying on you, Jamie, to tell us what the date of separation is. And that's the date we do the valuation, the primary date. There are also two additional dates potentially that could be either after date of separation or before date of separation. So the after date separation valuation is we call it date of trial or when the assets are divided. And so if there's a significant period of time between date of separation and the date of trial or division, and we think that their company's value may have changed, there could be a good reason to do a valuation to see what the value is and how it's changed. Sometimes there's a need to do a valuation before the date of separation, and that could be if the business started before the marriage or if there was gifts of interest to the spouse of the business interest before the date of separation.
Okay. And just to clear up for anyone who may not know, in North Carolina, the date of separation is the date that spouses begin to live under separate roofs with the intent of at least one of them, that the separation be permanent. We don't have any requirement in North Carolina that something be filed or that a contract be signed to establish that date of separation. It is simply the day that the two folks start to live in separate houses. You touched on this briefly about the value of the company potentially changing after the date of separation, but before the business is actually distributed to one of the parties. How do you handle that change in value?
That's a great question. And it's often a complex and difficult analysis. At a high level, we need to determine what is active and what is passive. And so if the value changed, is it due to active factors of the spouse? Or passive factors. Why did it grow or why did it change? And there are quantitative and qualitative factors that lead to the difference and ultimately our conclusion.
Can you give us some examples of what would be considered an active factor, something that a spouse actively did to change the value of the business?
I think being actively involved in management, their roles and responsibilities, and the comparison of their role versus third parties, the business model, is there an ability to replace the spouse? Product development, if they are actively changing the business model and adding new products, how involved they are with the sales relationships, the customer base, is there transferability of the value related to that spouse?
And you also mentioned that there could be passive factors. What are some examples of passive factors that might apply?
Yeah, I think the best example of that would be tax law changes. And so with TCJA, the tax legislation was passed applicable in 2018, tax rates affect evaluation because we're using and under the income approach, we're estimating the value of a company and we take into consideration tax rates. So as tax rates changed with that legislation, that produced a change in the overall value of a company. And so that's a passive change. Other changes could be GDP growth, consumer confidence, inflation, interest rates, customer spending, customer confidence, commodity prices, and things of that nature that are completely out of control of the owner's spouse.
And from a divorce standpoint, the reason that these factors are important and deciding whether they are active or whether they are passive is, you know, because how the difference in value is going to be handled. So if the business was valued on the date of separation and some passive factors cause that value to change before the date of trial or the date of distribution, we'll call it, then
that change in value is distributable. Whereas if the change in value is the result of the active efforts of the business owner's spouse, then that change in value is not going to necessarily be distributable, and it's going to be distributed to the party at that date of separation value. So, you know, you make our jobs as divorce lawyers a lot easier by helping us determine what is active and what is passive and what should be distributed to a spouse and what shouldn't.
Well, it's a fun exercise, and it gets particularly complicated. There's a case now going on where a spouse received gifts of stock in a particular business three or four times between date of marriage and date of separation. So in that case, you have to value the company at each of those and do an active passive analysis from each of those to the date of separation. So it's complicated, but enjoyable exercise.
I'm glad you find it enjoyable, because I certainly cannot handle that part of it. We've talked a lot about business valuation, how it works in the context of a divorce. Would you say that the uncertainty of the current economy has impacted business valuations in divorce cases?
Yeah, I think absolutely. The income approach likely is affected more. The market approach to a lesser degree. But if we go back to the income approach and what I the formula that I discussed, value equals the benefits of a company, future benefits of a company, divided by or over the rate of return, you know, the benefits could be up or down. You know, COVID has positively affected some companies, but a lot of companies, it's negative. And in the period of the positive or negative or the up or down, it could be short, it could be certain, it could be long, or it could be uncertain. Trying to determine what that is, again, because we're looking at what are the future benefits of a company, because we don't make an investment in anything for what it's done in the past. That may contribute to what we think about what it is capable of in the future. It certainly made things more difficult. It also affects the rate of return and some of the continued inflation effects. It also has an effect on the valuation. So on a different note, a lot of times evaluations are for smaller companies in equitable distribution context, we will capitalize a value. And so we will look at the historical performance of a company and see, you know, what's the best indicator of future performance. And we can take the history of a company and capitalize it forward to get our value. But with some of the uncertainty and not knowing what's going to happen in the future with some of these companies, we have to do what's called a discounted cash flow analysis, where we begin to project forward the earnings in the first year into the future, and then the second year in the future, and then the third, and then discount them back, which requires good projections from management.
When you are discounting the cash flow, how do you determine that discount rate?
Yeah, that's a great question. The best way to explain that is just using what's a phrase called the buildup method. With the capitalization rate, we typically build that up from the element of lack of risk to most risk. And so we'll start with the risk-free rate. So what is a safe rate, a safe investment rate? And that may be a T-bill or a bond 20 or 30 years. And then we say, what's the additional risk that's required to invest in an equity, a large cap stock, a large equity, maybe 5 to 6% or more. And so we add those elements together. And then we go a step further and we say, the additional risk or return that's required for an equity, I mentioned, is for larger companies. Well, a lot of the companies that we're valuing in North Carolina for equitable distribution purposes are not nearly as large as a GE or an Apple or Tesla or whatever. And so there's an additional rate of return that you, the investor, are going to require for a smaller company. There's inherent more risk in those companies. And so we also consider an additional risk premium for industries. If a normal equity risk premium is X, but there's a particular industry that's more risky on the whole or less risky, we may add or subtract for there as well. And then the final component is the company-specific risk. And so we'll look at and say, are there other elements or other factors of this company that are risky? And so some of those could be, is there a concentration in customers? Is there a lack of management and things of that nature that add to the risk? So the buildup method, so the risk-free rate, the equity risk premium, and industry risk premium, and then the company-specific premium. And once we add all those up, that is our discount rate.
We talked about the uncertain economy impacting business valuations. Is there any way to mitigate that impact?
I can answer that question from two perspectives. So from the business perspective, it's reduce risk, reduce risk, reduce risk. And I just talked about the company-specific risk premium. And so wherever you can, reduce risk. And so if there's one customer that makes up 60% of revenue, we, as much as possible, need to try to diversify that. Same thing with staffing and employees, and build a bench and train people and grow people. Improve the accounting function. Poor financial statements is bad for a lot of reasons. There's inability to manage the business, which produces risk. When we go to do our evaluation, it can produce problems. Another way to mitigate the impact is to quantify revenue and understand the profitability drivers, what's causing the company to produce revenue and grow, and what revenue streams are most profitable. And so understand fixed costs and overhead and focus on the areas in which we're most profitable. I mentioned earlier the capitalization method or a discounting method. And so in a capitalization method, we need to be able to quantify, you know, what are the COVID years and why, and being able to quantify that and understanding revenue is a big part of that. And then from the discounted cash flow method, we need to be able to support projections. So one of the ways in which we can mitigate the risk is being able to understand where our company is going the best we can, business owners wise.
What credentials should a person be looking for when they are choosing a business valuator to help them?
The three primary credentials would be CVA, so Certified Valuation Analyst, which is what I am, an ABV, which is Accredited in Business Valuation. There's also ASA, Accredited Senior Appraiser. For some other, I think, equitable distribution related cases or engagements may come up, I think CPA is important. Someone that understands business, someone that understands accounting, can speak the language and understand the financials it can be helpful. Also CFF, Certified in Financial Forensics, or MAFF, Master Analyst in Financial Forensics. That's probably a whole other podcast.
Absolutely. In your experience, how much does a business valuation typically cost?
I don't know if we talked about it. I don't think we did, but there are two types of valuations that are available under the standards. One is a conclusion of value. And a conclusion of value requires the appraiser to look at all three approaches that we mentioned, the asset approach, the income approach, and the market approach. It's typically more involved, and the result of that engagement evaluator, I'm going to say our conclusion of value is X. And so it carries more weight, if you will, than a calculation of value. Calculation of value, under the standards, we can, in discussions with management or the attorney, decide which approach we want to look at. And so maybe it's an income approach, but the results of that engagement is going to be the results of our calculations of value are X. And so if something were going to trial, we would most certainly need a conclusion of value. Because Jamie, if you were on the other side and you said, Mr. Amos, what's your conclusion of value? And I said, well, I don't have a conclusion. You might tear me to shreds. And so sometimes calculations of value can be used for mediation or internal purposes at some point in the litigation process. But a conclusion of value will be needed later. Conclusion of values typically range from 15 to 18,000. And a calculation of value from 7 to 10.
And I believe you and I discussed another type of, not really a report that you could do, but isn't there an oral opinion of value? What is that?
So the standards allow us to give an oral report or a written report. And depending on the context and the users of the report and of the valuation, you may or may not need a written report. Sometimes that there are things that can be put in an evaluation report that are fodder for counsel to push back on and potentially impugn the credibility of the report or the result. And so the evaluator, along with the attorney, need to be careful and thinking about that. One alternative to a written report is an oral report. And in an oral report, the evaluator typically will do everything that they would normally do in a written report. The development standards are the same, so they got to do all the work they would normally do. But in lieu of writing report that may be anywhere from 30, 50 to 120 pages, they will give valuation schedules to the users, to you, Jamie, and potentially the spouses, the schedules. And those schedules will include the historical financial statements, analysis, ratio analysis, trend analysis, and all the work financially and schedules that go from beginning to end. So from the historical information adjustments, normalization adjustments to the final value of the company. You know, if you're going to mediation and you're not going to exchange reports, it can be a good tool. I think it's a facts and circumstances, and I would never want you, the attorney, I would never want to advise you the attorney, or any of your clients, any people listening, you know, to do an oral report when a written report was needed. And so, but I think that there are options, there are tools in the toolbox, if you will.
You know, it could be a way to save your clients some money if you're just trying to get a case settled. There's no litigation, but you need some sort of idea of what the business is worth. I mean, it might be a less expensive option.
I think so. I enjoy what I do. And I look at what I do is help cross the divide, if you will. There is a divide, and the objective is to get across it. It's not my job or any other evaluator's job to push a conclusion of value or a written report or a more expensive option when something less is there. You know, sometimes we'll do a calculation for mediation purposes, and then it doesn't settle mediation. It goes to trial, and then we'll go do a conclusion of value. And in that case, we'll have to go back and do some more work. But it's not the calculation on top of the conclusion. But I do want to present options to you, the attorney, or into the spouses, see what's the best way to try to get this thing settled.
So this is a very basic question, but given the cost associated with a business valuation, I'm sure folks are wondering, how do you know if you really need a business valuation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have a simple tool or a simple guide that essentially acts like a flow chart, if you will, just to ask questions. Do I have a business? Do I own a business? And then going from there, you know, is there, I talked about earlier, the asset approach a lot of times is a floor value. And so the assets minus the liabilities, it may only be worth $100,000, but because that's just the tangible value, right? There are intangibles such as goodwill or customer list, name recognition, an assembled workforce, and other things that are intangible value that you may only see through the income approach. And so, you know, do you if you take your assets minus your liabilities, and is there a positive result? Well, if that's the case, then there's probably value. If there's not, then there's some questions on the flow chart just to say, well, why is that? Is that because your business is early on in its life cycle? Is it because there hasn't been capital? And if you have capital, you can produce a profit. Or if there are, you know, sometimes with small businesses, people pay, the owners pay themselves salaries that may be higher than or more or exceed reasonable compensation. And so if we adjust those out to a reasonable amount, is there potential income there? And so it can be a tool, a general tool, to at least get you in a direction of knowing, hey, do I need one or not?
If any of our listeners are interested in seeing a copy of that flow chart, is that something that you could share?
No, absolutely. I can share it with you as soon as we get off the podcast.
All right. That's great. Do you have any tips for people headed for divorce in situations where a business interest is going to be involved?
Yes. And for all that are listening, Jamie didn't ask me to say this, but talk to an attorney that has an experience dealing with BV and ED. With business valuation in equitable distribution context, I've seen when I've been in the courtroom and observed valuators and business valuation folks that are testifying an opposing expert and their attorney wasn't that knowledgeable on business valuation. And some of the questions they asked or didn't ask, or some of the objections that they didn't make, put the expert and ultimately the value of the company and the settlement at risk. And so as an evaluator, I want to work with folks that have experience dealing with this. And I can tell you that if anybody's going through divorce, it's good to talk to an attorney that has experience dealing with business valuation. I think the other thing I would mention is get your information together. The soundness of the accounting function and most or all the time that you spend working towards this is valuable. And so have a good CPA. The time that you invest in this, it'll help the valuation. It'll help the valuation expert deliver a credible report. And at the end of the day, better information going in will produce a better result and hopefully a settlement in the case and potentially reduce the cost of the valuation and the litigation.
That's a great point. I mean, with all the time, effort, don't forget money that's going into this report, you want it to be credible. And so you want those underlying financials that are being used for the report to be credible and to be good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today. If any of our listeners would like to contact you, what is the best way for them to reach you?
Probably email. Email address is D-A-M-I-S-S, so first name, first initial and last name, D-A-M-I-S-S@CRICPA.com.
I hope you all enjoyed this episode of A Year in a Day. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, I would love to hear from you. You can email me at jdavis@divorcestop.com. As a reminder, while in my role as a lawyer, my job is to give folks legal advice. The purpose of this podcast is not to do that. This podcast is for general informational purposes only, should not be used as legal advice, and is specific to the law in North Carolina. If you have any questions before you take any action, you should consult with a lawyer who's licensed in your state.